You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I'm joined in the park at Red Lion Square by the president of Louisiana State University, F. King Alexander, and Dan Lazel, vice president for finance and administration. Nice to have you both here. Dr. Alexander, you've been in the role at LSU for about a year exactly, give or take. Before that, you were president at California State University, Long Beach. How's the first year been?
The first year actually has been a bit of a surprise for us. I think that we're starting to see states coming out of the economic downturns that we've experienced, and Louisiana is much like many other states, and we believe that we have suffered through a period of time that was much worse in California, but also many of our states are starting to recover, and we believe funding is starting to come back to our institution, which is certainly evident by this year's legislative session.
Mm-hmm. And how about comparisons between those two institutions? They are both state institutions, of course. Is funding the main sort of area that you look at in terms of issues and problems that need to be solved?
I would say for public higher education in America, the number one issue is whether states are going to play a major role in the funding of their public universities in the next decade. And that issue is first and foremost on my agenda when I go to Washington, and first and foremost in my speeches when I talk about which states are going to stay in the public higher education arena and which states are quickly abandoning their responsibilities to the next generation of students.
We'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but your appointment a year ago wasn't without controversy. I think it's probably fair to say there was a vote of no confidence in LSU's governing board by the Faculty Senate, which felt the process leading to your appointment wasn't transparent enough. They also said you hadn't been a tenured professor at a major research institution. How do you tackle those sort of issues which are in the press around the time when you walk into campus on day one?
Well, you just understand that having done this at public universities for 14 years, that these issues pop up. They pop up all around the country. The concern I think that the newspapers expressed was the fact that numerous candidates were not made available to the faculty. Numerous candidates were not made available to the press. And unfortunately, in the environment that we're in American higher education, most people are not going to apply if their names are going to be released to the public at large, because they could put in jeopardy their own current position in another state or at another institution. So it's something that's going on throughout the United States, concern about whether or not people will make their name public when these types of positions open up.
Mm, that's an interesting point. We mentioned funding earlier. Louisiana State's under Republican control at state level, first time for a while. Does that mean there's a squeeze on funds coming through from the state government? Does it make a difference if you're in a Democratic or a Republican state? I mean, what's the trend?
Well, Dan, if you want to comment, and I'll give my two cents.
Well, I think probably the driver that we've seen, not just in Louisiana, but from in other states, and I came to Louisiana from Illinois, which was democratically, there was Democratic governor and a legislature, and you know, we'd suffered through several years of funding downturns too. The economy really, I think, has been the primary driver. Now the economy is starting to turn around in many areas of the country, but I think one of the changes that we're going to see from what we've seen in the past is, you know, states are and the country are going to start looking at what can higher education contribute to the economic and social well-being of states, and so I think that's really going to be our challenge moving forward in terms of. Building further support is showing that we are, in fact, working with state and federal government to address issues of state national concern.
Yeah, and I'd say in fact, the experiences I've had in Louisiana, it has very little to do with whether you're a Democrat or Republican. It's about having our institutions and our universities playing a role in the economic development and talking about outcomes and not simply saying, restore funds that we've lost because, trust us, we're worth it. We've had to demonstrate that we're worth additional investments, and I've been very pleased with the leadership that we've been working with in Governor Jindal and our legislative leadership in Louisiana that also sees the role of higher education going forward in producing the types of graduates that will fuel the economy in the future. And I've been fortunate to work for good Republican governors and bad Republican governors, and good Democratic governors and bad Democratic governors in Kentucky and California. So I think it has little to do with whether they have an R or D, but more importantly, whether they understand that higher education plays a significant role in the economic growth and development of the state.
Yeah, I would agree.
But some states are looking for a way out, or indeed have plans in place to cease the funding of higher education altogether. Do you look at those places? I mean, Colorado, we mentioned before we started the interview. Do you look at those places with an eye of slight concern?
I'd say even more than slight concern. I think that even our federal government in 1972 established the direct student loan program under the assumption that states are going to maintain their commitments to higher education. Well, I'm very concerned that within about a 10-year, within one decade, we're going to start seeing a couple states falling right off the map and not spending a single penny on higher education or the next generation of students, essentially pushing the cost of higher education entirely onto the backs of the next generation of students. That concerns me deeply, and we watch it very closely, and we're trying to make sure that the federal government is paying close attention to this issue as well.
And do you have plans in place for what would happen if those funds did dry up? I mean, you must have to look elsewhere in that case. You can shift it on in terms of fees, as you say, but there must be other income streams you can exploit too.
Certainly. I mean, we look at both sides of the equation. We're looking at not just additional revenue sources, and again, keeping in mind we are very committed to maintaining an affordable higher education, but also areas in which we can reduce costs, control costs, become more efficient in terms of our operations. So again, we're focused on both sides of the ledger, both the expense and the revenue.
And we have to be, because states now constitute about 25% of our budget, and we're about average nationwide. So it's no longer do we have public institutions with 80% of their budgets coming from the state. So we've got to be resourceful. We've got to generate additional revenues, whether that's from auxiliary funding, athletics, other sources of funds that help our institution progress as we go into the future.
And what's it meant for fees at LSU over, say, the last 5 years or so? I understand it's around about $8,000 a year at the moment. Is that noticeably up on, say, 5 years ago?
It's certainly up like it is around the country. It's noticeably up on what we used to charge, but we still are about $2,000 below the national average. And our students, we're very pleased to say, we really aren't the type of institution that has been the cause of the college cost crisis in the United States, nor are we the type of institution that has caused the student indebtedness crisis, of which only about a third of our students have any debt whatsoever when they graduate.
And where would you point the finger in terms of institutions that perhaps were responsible?
I would certainly point my finger towards what I call the Maryland to Maine phenomenon that we have in the United States, where most of our highest cost institutions reside. We've got over 30 institutions that charge over $60,000 a year, and over 150 charging $50,000 or more. And I have great concern about the direction of many of those institutions, the fact that they are publicly funded, which many in Britain don't understand, is that 7,000 public and private and for-profit institutions in the United States are getting public funds each and every year. I think we need to scrutinize those public funds and ensure that they're going to places that are not radically escalating college costs or radically escalating the percentage of students going into massive debt.
There's a presidential election looming. I was speaking to Nicholas Dirks, your counterpart at Berkeley, recently in a podcast as well. He seemed to observe that HE is a much more significant issue for the US public this time around than perhaps it has been in previous elections. And he mentioned things like the mounting student debt as aspects of that. Would you go along with that? Do you think it's much more in the public eye in the run-up to the election than it has been previously?
No, I think so. I think, and we see this in Louisiana, we're seeing it all over the country. You know, students are wondering what the value of their education is when they get out into the economy after they've spent, they and their families have spent thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they get out and they can find, part-time jobs or full-time jobs that barely help them pay back their debt. So I think, yes, I mean, it's a concern.
And I think Dan's exactly right on this. I think that the nation is starting to ask the right questions about higher education. What's going to happen when our students graduate? And our students are asking these questions. Am I going to get a useful job? Am I going to have good mid-career earnings? Or am I going to be saddled with part of the $1.3 trillion in debt that students have in the United States? And we've got an obligation and responsibility to make these outcomes available to students. And I think Congress is asking these questions, and they're right, they're justified in asking these questions. So I do think higher ed is going to be a much more important issue, especially at a time when 93%, recent Gallup poll shows that 93% of our parents want their kids to go to college. Mm-hmm. And we need to make sure that it's affordable. We're giving them good quality degrees, which cannot be said throughout the United States with many for-profit institutions that are indeed going under, that have taken a great deal of public money and left students with virtually a degree that's not getting them anywhere in life.
Parents are increasingly going to want to know the quality of degree that their children will get from universities. And you've brought with you, I have it in front of me, the college scorecard, something that Obama sort of introduced or said he was going to introduce across the country in the near future. And there's one here for LSU. It's got a few dials on it. Shows that your costs are typically below average. It's got graduation rate, which is in the high percentile here at 60%, give or take. It's got your median borrowing for the institution. This is all the kind of information that I guess parents are very, very hungry for. Do you think these scorecards will be a success? Because we've had a lot of people criticize.
Well, a lot of institutions are criticizing them because they really don't want to have that information available to parents. And I think it's putting a great degree of responsibility on our universities. I talk to parents all the time at orientation. I talk to parents recruiting. I talk to parents. They love this information, and they clamor to get a hold of this type of information. And it is certainly not available in most of the private magazines that rank institutions based on how selective they are, not based on how their graduates are doing in the marketplace or how well the institution succeeds with the student bodies that they have. So we welcome this information. We are working with the White House and the Department of Education to ensure that parents have access to this type of information. And the more we talk about value, we believe that the more parents will understand where there truly is great value in American higher education and which institutions can they acquire that from.
Yeah. No, I mean, and just speaking personally, in fact, King and I can both speak personally. He's got two daughters who are going to be new freshmen this fall. I've got a son who's going to be a new freshman this fall. And frankly, as a parent, this kind of information is very important to me because, you know, I mean, is my son going to be able to get a job when he graduates from college in the field that he's studying?
Yeah. I have concern from my colleagues at many institutions that really do not want to provide this information to parents because they're concerned that they've overcharged, or their concern is that their graduates just aren't producing the types of results that they're telling parents at orientation or what they're telling parents when they're recruiting.
They're all quite hard and fast measures, though, aren't they? You know, price per year, the graduation rate, which obviously is a big issue for U.S. universities in general. Do you think it gets to the heart of the softer skills, the softer side of university college experience, the people you meet, the networks you create while you're there? Because you can't make a chart and produce a graph that shows that, can you?
Well, but you can actually understand that if the students are progressing towards graduation and they're doing it and you trust your campus and your faculty and staff, that they're acquiring all those other skills that you're talking about while they're attending, while they're staying in school, and that's an end result of some things that we can measure.
Yeah. No, I mean, and King's exactly right. I mean, you know, you do not find good retention and graduation rates at institutions where students are not engaged in their college experience, which again, true, it's more qualitative kind of a measure, but they're part and parcel together.
Yeah, they work hand in hand, and the fact that this is the beginning of measuring new forms of outcomes that our institutions have been producing, and I think that with the amount of money that parents and students are shelling out, the era of saying trust us, we're worth it, is over. And we're saying, look at what our graduates can do, look at what they're doing, and we want your sons and daughters to be a part and adult learners to be a part of what we believe will get you to the next career or the next step in your economic stability.
What do you think the legacy more generally will be of Obama's years in the White House? You know, in a couple of years' time after the next election, you look back at what he's done in the HE sector, do you think it's been a success?
Well, I think there's some remarkable success stories that have happened. One, the whole direct lending, which most people have forgotten about, The whole direct lending movement took our banks out of the middle of the student loan industry. There were all kinds of fraud and abuses that were going on, and our students were getting saddled with debt and high interest rates and fluctuating interest rates, and we did not even have income contingent payback plans that were in place. So I think from the beginning we've seen, number one, the direct lending approach being a government entity now, and it's made more funds available to students at much more effective in much more effective ways. I'd say a second benefit that most people don't know is the American Opportunity Tax Credit. Currently, about 60% of American parents are also getting $2,500 back every year, up to about $180,000 in family incomes. So they're getting, which amounts to about $20 billion in federal subsidies to allow children and students and kids to go to college. So we've got a number of successful wins. I do think the scorecard will be perceived years from now as being the beginning of an effective way to start measuring the effectiveness of colleges and universities. And we certainly hope that by the end of his administration that we're able to carve out a federal-state matching partnership that re-engages those states like Colorado and Iowa that are getting out of higher education and puts a little bit of pressure or incentivizes them to stay in the funding schemes for higher education in the future.
We alluded slightly to sport earlier. I think before we started recording, you sort of told me that the income you generate from your sporting activities is at least comparable to what you get from the state. Is that right?
That's exactly yes. Right. Yes, that
so
is.
So it's around about $120 million.
About $120 million.
For each. I did a bit of research before we met. You've got a tiger. I know that this is something in the UK we don't really do. The mascot, the face of the university is often not the highest achieving student or the president such as yourself. It's usually as an animal dressed up in the team's colours. But at Louisiana, you actually have a real tiger. Indeed, you're onto your sixth incarnation of Mike the Tiger. How did that come about?
Well, that's been around for almost a century now. Mike the Tiger is the third largest tourist attraction in the state of Louisiana. Our veterinary students, we have a veterinary medicine program that take great pride in taking care of Mike the Tiger, who's a 600-pound Siberian tiger who lives in a $3 million enclosure facility that's nicer than probably most zoos have around the world. So it's a great source of pride for our students, a great source of pride for our alumni, and it's what helps the uniqueness of Louisiana and certainly LSU.
And he's still wheeled out on match days in a cage with cheerleaders dancing on the top.
When he's willing. If Mike doesn't want to come out, Mike doesn't come out.
We give Mike the opportunity to come out on a game day and travel around the field. But Mike comes out about every third game or so and enjoys the spectacle of it. Then he goes back into his encampment and everybody takes pictures around him. But he's quite a tourist attraction for the university.
Yeah. And he's he always has a very contented look on his face.
Well, that's good to hear. Does he? I mean, you must utilize Mike, if that's not too crude a phrase, in educational activities as well. Do your students sort of look after him?
Our veterinary medicine students take care of Mike, along with our faculty that are. We take care of. We have a big agricultural program, a veterinary medicine program, so we take care of the state's livestock. That's part of the responsibility of an A&M university, which is engineering and agricultural sciences. Our students take great pride in him, but more importantly, the number of school children that come to the university that may be the first time they've ever set foot on the campus, they always go because they want to see Mike. They want to see Mike and get their pictures taken over near Mike, but it actually attracts so many school children to our campus so they can experience what it's like on a university campus and not be afraid of a university campus, but start expecting that perhaps someday they can come to school at LSU and be a part of the university as well.
So you're saying you can make campuses less frightening by putting tigers on
them? I'm not sure one follows the other, but he works for us.
It works well for us.
F. King Alexander, Dan Lazel, thanks very much for meeting and talking with me today.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.